Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
This is Stuart Venner. I tell it as I see it, and I see it as it is.
It was interesting, but it was also stupid.
This is Stuart Venner. I want to welcome you to this week's show. We've got a great lineup of guests. We're speaking to Rob Oliver. Rob is going to talk to us about finding success as a paraplegic. We're also speaking to an old friend of mine, Arthur Schenker. Arthur is the son of Morris Schenker. Morris was CEO of the Dunes Hotel in Las Vegas and Jimmy Hoffa's lawyer. We're speaking to Judy Brizendine. Judy is talking to us about dealing with grief and the loss of a loved one. We're speaking to Karna Bodman. Karna was the former senior director of national security under Ronald Reagan, and at one time was the highest ranking woman in the United States executive office. We're also finally speaking to Tiffany van der Lucht. She's the author of The Radical Self-Help Expert. Stay tuned. I know you're going to really love this show. I have Rob Oliver on the phone. Rob is quite an interesting guy, and he has quite a story to tell. Rob is a motivational speaker, and a very good one from what I hear. He's helped a lot of people, but the most interesting thing is Rob is, a paraplegic and possibly even a partial quadriplegic. He had a very bad accident. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Stuart.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. Could you tell us a little bit about your story and what happened to you?
Sure. It was about 20 years ago. I was body surfing on the Outer Banks in North Carolina when a wave that I was riding towards the shore, instead of it carrying me forward, it actually pushed me down. I hit my head on the bottom, and I broke my neck at that. And as you mentioned, I'm a quad, so I have no use of my legs and have limited use of my arms and hands.
Yet you productively work, you have a family, and you've been able to really overcome this.
Well, it actually started about 3 days after the injury. I learned my very most valuable lesson in my whole life. I was having a conversation with my girlfriend at the time, and I said to her, we got to talk about us. I don't know what the future holds, but it looks like it holds a lot of limitations. And if those are too overwhelming for you, I care about you. I want you to be okay, and it's all right with me if you leave. I said, I don't know what pressure you're feeling from other people, but they're not a part of us. This is about you and me, and I want you to be okay. And I said, the last thing is, I don't know what exactly you're feeling towards me, but if you're just feeling sorry for me, if you're feeling pity, that's not the foundation for a lasting relationship. And that's not what I want, and if that's what you're feeling, it's okay if you leave.
What did she do?
She got really mad at me with big tears in her eyes. She said, listen, what I love about you has nothing to do with whether or not you can walk. I love you for who you are on the inside. And if you think you can get rid of me that easy, you've got another thing coming.
So you had a real winner there. Did you marry her?
Absolutely. When you find somebody like that, you marry them. But the important thing is she taught me that it's all about who you are on the inside. It's about that personal connection. It's about being yourself. And so it's a matter of now engaging life. Even though I had physical limitations, I'm still myself, and I still have value to her and to others because of who I am.
And, you know, things can happen, and it can happen in a flash, like what happened to you. But so many people will just say that's the end of the world, but you can continue. You know, your story sounds very similar to what happened to Charles Krauthammer on Fox News. He's a brilliant man, and he had an accident in the swimming pool where he hit his head as a teenager, and he didn't let it limit him either.
Absolutely. There's a number of people out there that have limitations that are fairly significant, and people look at. I think about a year ago, there was a young lady named Annie Clark from the Pittsburgh area, and she won national recognition for penmanship, in spite of the fact that she had been born without hands.
What'd she write with her toes?
In front of the story of people overcoming what they face on a daily basis.
That's amazing. Rob, tell us about what you're doing, because you're a pretty busy guy and a pretty active person and a successful person. Tell us about what you do.
Well, what I do to pay the bills is I work as an advocate for an organization that takes care of making sure that people with disabilities are not being neglected, abused, or having their rights violated. And in my spare time, then, I am a speaker, and I share my message with a variety of audiences, anywhere from kids in elementary and high school through university, talking to different corporate events as well, just to say, listen, everybody has problems, everybody has limitations, and life is all about what we do. I think John Wooden had a great quote that said something along the lines of, nobody ever succeeded by focusing on what they can't do. And that's really, I think, what the message is.
I think that's so true. So you are an advocate for the American with Disabilities Act and helping see that everyone complies with that.
I am, but I think that the message really is bigger than that, Stuart. My message is one that the human condition is a condition of limitation. I was joking with a high school class that I spoke at recently, and they had brought me in as a finale for their week of statewide standardized testing. And the question is, who took the test? And, of course, everybody puts their hand up. And who got them all right? And there was only about a handful of smart alecks that kept their hand up to say, we got them all right. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's 100% correctly.
That's true. I mean, I made a mistake one time myself. That was the time I thought I was wrong, and I actually wasn't.
Stuart, my joke is that I'm married, and therefore I am very well aware of every mistake that I make.
That's good. You know, now with disabilities, I think they've made obese people a disability.
There are any number of disabilities.
Of course. Do you ever sit in an airplane between two elephants?
It's a difficult thing.
It is. But, you know, joking aside, you've done a remarkable thing, and I really take my hat off to you. So you are active, you make a good living, you support your family, you do public speaking, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm actually working on my second book. I wrote my autobiography.
Oh, tell us about your book. I'd like to know about that.
Sure. It's the story of how I ended up in the chair and some of the things that I've learned since then. I've got a number of stories in there about perspective. One of the things that is kind of an interesting story in itself is not only am I a quad, but I am also father of triplets. I have 11-year-old triplets that fill my life with all types of energy. But again, that's one of the stories that's in the book about how you get the perspective on it. We had gone through a lot trying to get pregnant, trying to have kids. And when we finally got the news that, hey, we are pregnant, I was just so excited.
My wife
went for her first ultrasound, and they said, guess what, you're having twins. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic.
And it turned out to be triplets.
Yeah, well, the next sonogram said, there's three of them, at which point my response was, right, stop with the sonograms already.
Now, was she taking fertility drugs?
We had done this through in vitro, so there was all types of medical intervention up to that point. So, yes, there was one of those things where you learn that there are statistical possibilities of all kinds of
sure.
stuff. But what we as a couple were hearing was...
Rob, your book is called Still Walking, right?
Correct.
And how can people get your book? How can they read it, buy it? Tell us about that.
It's available on Amazon, or you can get it on my website. It is yourmotivationalspeaker.com. It's available there. You can save a little bit of money on shipping over Amazon if you get it there.
Well, Rob, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. And everybody out there, we're speaking to Rob Oliver. His website is yourmotivationalspeaker.com. And you can get his book, Still Walking. And if you want, you can also get it at amazon.com. Rob, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. Buyyourtimeshare.com. That's buyyourtimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
Folks, welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest and an old friend online, a friend for probably about 35 years. We're speaking to Arthur Schenker. Arthur's father was Morris Schenker, who was CEO of the Dunes. He was also the most famous mob lawyer, I think, in history. He testified in the Kefauver hearings back in the 50s, and he was Jimmy Hoffa's personal attorney. Arthur, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, George. Good to be talking to you.
The same here, my friend. Tell us a little bit about your dad, and I know you're in the process of putting a book together.
I am. You know, Dad's history, of course, starts back in Russia where he was born, and it's the typical immigrant American story, coming to America and making it big. Learning English, coming here with nothing, learning English through the Jesuits. Funny enough, who
really?
Put him through St. Louis University.
Interesting.
And going to law school.
And how did he become involved with the Teamsters and Jimmy Hoffa and so forth?
Well, it was a transition starting in the 40s when he started representing some of the people in labor and some of the racketeering folks between East St. Louis who were part of the old Capone gang, a guy named Frank Buster Wortman. And some of the St. Louis fellas named like John Vitale and Anthony Giordano and Shorty Ralph Kalika, and in his involvement with them, and then in the late 40s and 50s, and moving into the Kefauver hearings, where he represented more bookmakers and people of that caliber than any other attorney in the country. That boosted him up, and then, of course, got involved with heavily into labor unions.
And what brought him to Las Vegas? That's where I knew him, because I actually worked with your dad for a little while.
Well, what brought him to Las Vegas is after the Kefauver hearings, yes. A couple of his clients, Sid Wyman and Charlie Rich especially, where no one got indicted that he represented, and he said, look, guys, why don't we just go on out to Las Vegas, and let's find a place. And they came out here, and they opened up an old hotel called the Royal Nevada, which didn't last very long.
Right.
And from there, Dad was always their attorney. From there, they went to the Riviera, and eventually landed at the Dunes. My father started accumulating stock, and we actually had a partner named Irvin Kahn out of San Diego who was going to be the managing partner. But Irv died, and we ended up migrating out of St. Louis and coming out here to run the Dunes.
And your dad was the chairman of the board, and you were president, weren't you, Arthur?
I was. He was chairman of the board. I was vice chairman of the board, and I was president of Dunes Hotels Casinos, Inc., which was a public company that owned the stock in the hotel.
And I was working with your dad on some financing at the time. He was, I think he was seven stories up in Steele in New Jersey.
Right. We were seven stories up in New Jersey. You were an unbelievable help with trying to help us get the financing through sources overseas and here in the country.
Right. I remember those days. I really had a lot of respect for your dad. He was about the age of my father, and he wasn't a contemporary of mine, but I was very respectful of him, and I cannot tell you what a great man he was.
Well, I really appreciate you thinking that. I think, obviously, he was a great man, too, because along with his law practice, he was also a tremendous humanitarian and philanthropist who did many things for not only local charities, but also for Israel Bonds and Jewish Federation. Also created probably one of his greatest accomplishments, Stuart, was co-founding the Dismas House, which was the first halfway house for criminals in the country. And they did make a movie about that called The Hoodlum Priest, starring Don Murray.
Hmm. Now, I know you're working on this book. We mentioned it briefly, but it's going to be telling all of this, and we don't want to give too much away, but I know that we had spoken before, and the day before Hoffa disappeared, you actually spoke to him, and so did your dad.
We both spoke to him. Jimmy called the hotel, and Dad was on another line. I spoke to him. My conversation was very casual. Dad's conversation lasted obviously a lot longer when he got to the phone, but I'm pretty sure that if my father thought that Jimmy was going to be in trouble, he'd have probably been on the next plane and been with him.
Sure, and I think the big thing that got him, we had talked about it, is the fact that he was going to try to run for union office and get back involved.
That what he was trying to do was make peace with a fellow named Tony Provenzano out of New Jersey, and the two of them became enemies. Tony Pro ran one of the big locals out of New Jersey, and they were going to try to make peace, and Jimmy wanted to run again. And, of course, the deal that my father had made with the Nixon administration on his parole, getting him out, was that he would never be a union officer again in organized labor.
And he violated that.
And he violated that. I actually have a one-line note that my father had Jimmy write to him while he was still in prison, before he went to Nixon. My father actually got him to write a one-line note that was his personal pledge to my father that he would never run for office again.
And that violating that is probably what got him where he...
And violating that is probably what got him killed. I think Fitzsimmons loved being in the position he was in. I think that the government liked Fitzsimmons being where he was. And I think people on the other side also liked Fitzsimmons being where he was.
Well, Fitzsimmons,
no one wanted Hoffa back in because Hoffa was his own man.
Yeah, you couldn't control Jimmy Hoffa.
No, he was his own man.
And your dad was also responsible for a lot of the funding in Vegas through the Teamsters Pension Fund, correct?
Very true. Not only for Las Vegas, but for many other entities outside of Las Vegas, also, especially in Southern California.
Well, your dad was old-time Las Vegas, and there weren't really, I don't know if any of those guys still around today.
They really aren't. The only people that are around are probably just the sons or daughters of those people.
Yeah.
You got Benny Binion's long gone. Sam Boyd is long gone. Mo Dalitz is long gone. You know,
Gus Greenbaum is long, long gone.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they got him at Phoenix, he and his wife.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, but in today, of course, back then it was all private ownership, and today it's all, corporate.
That's what happened when Howard Hughes, I think, took over the town, basically.
That started it.
That started it, yes.
That started it. But Howard Hughes still had people that he had working for him and in charge that knew the gambling business and really knew the business well. I think today, in the corporate structure, one, Las Vegas, I think, lost a lot of glamour.
It has. I mean, back in the old days.
And the second thing is, I think that they don't take care of the people the way they used to. When somebody walked into the dunes, from the front door all the way through, it was Mr. V, Mr. T, Mr. S, Mr. R. Everybody knew the players, from the bellman, from the valet parkers to the bellman. Today, it's like, let me take your car, get inside, gamble, get out, we don't care who you are.
Yep, you buy tickets to see a show, and they're expensive.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it never was that way. And Vegas used to be, today, people actually rob casinos. That would have been unheard of back in the old days.
Right. They didn't dare back in the old days.
I mean, there's a big desert out there.
Yeah.
Don't rob casinos.
And funny enough, they always talk about the old days and the days that the mob ran Las Vegas. You know, when you came out here, you didn't see mobsters running around in the hotels. You didn't see Sam Giancana or the Columbos or those guys. They weren't visible.
No, and it was a safe town for people.
And it was very safe. You could walk from hotel to hotel, and you didn't have to worry about getting robbed or mugged. It was just different. We didn't have gangs there like the motorcycle gangs.
No, that would have been unheard of.
None of that was here.
Well, Arthur, I think that this is going to be so exciting. The book you write, I mean, your dad was the true mob lawyer. Oscar Goodman says he's a mob lawyer, but he was nothing compared to what your father's done.
Well, it was a different era. It was a totally different era. Back in the, Oscar practiced more in the 70s and 80s. Dad was when it was really strong back in the, it was after the 30s, obviously, because Dad didn't get out of law school until 1932, but
sure.
It was in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s when there was a tremendous amount going on all over the country between New York, Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis.
Arthur, I can't thank you enough. We could go on, and we'll do this again because there's no limit to how much we can talk about this. But again, everybody, we're talking to Arthur Schenker. His father was Morris Schenker from the Dunes Hotel, attorney for the mob, attorney for Jimmy Hoffa. And everybody, wait, that book is going to be coming, and I know that you're all going to want to read it because I certainly can't wait to read it. It's going to be fascinating. Arthur, thank you so much.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. Buyyourtimeshare.com. That's buyyourtimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
Trying to survive, the glow that the sun gives by the sunset helps me realize this is just
Welcome back to the show, folks. I'm speaking to Judy Brizendine. Judy is going to talk to us about dealing with grief. She's had some tragedy in her life, which can really happen to any of us. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Stuart. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. Judy, tell me a little bit about what happened in your life that caused this you to get into this.
Well, my introduction to grief came very suddenly. My husband went on a mountain bike ride, just as he had done hundreds of times before, only on that particular day back in 1998, he didn't come home.
Oh, my goodness.
There was a major heart event that happened, and he collapsed. He happened to be taking a shortcut through an apartment complex. He was only about a mile from our home when that happened. Paramedics were called. They came immediately, tried to revive him, couldn't, took him to the hospital, and they declared him dead.
And did he have a heart condition before that?
No, he didn't. He had an irregular heartbeat, but he had had virtually every kind of test done. He had had a catheterization. He had had electrical mapping. He had had all sorts of things done to his heart. And we had been assured time and time again that there was nothing wrong with his heart that was going to kill him.
So the doctors had given him the green light for this exercise and to do this.
They told him that the, you know, the irregular heartbeats were a nuisance that he would just have to put up with, but there was nothing mechanically wrong with his heart not to worry.
So it was the tachycardia, is that what he had?
Well, he went into AFib a few times, and they actually tried through the mapping to put him into VFib and to locate that faulty circuit so that they could, you know, fix it, ablate it.
And well, that must have been a terrible event to happen to you, coming unexpected, and things like this can happen to anyone. Whether it be a medical event or a car accident or anything, in a flash, any one of us can be gone.
Absolutely.
And it, I guess it leaves a horrible void for our loved ones. And what did you do to, and what you've written a book about this, what have you done to try to help yourself and to help others?
Well, one reason that I wrote this book was because I found through all of these years later, research, leading grief support groups, that we don't really know much about grief until it happens to us. You know, it's something that people don't want to talk about, they don't want to learn about. It's almost as though they fear if they get too close to it, it's going to happen to them. And so there's even a bit of superstition about, you know, just keeping the whole thing as
sure,
then
you
possible.
You want to deny it until you have
right.
no choice. And are you leaving? Are you doing grief counseling for people? What have you done?
No, I'm not doing that. What I've been doing in recent years is really trying to educate people about this thing called grief that none of us are going to escape. And when it happens, you know, people are at a complete loss as to what to do. And grief literally affects every single part of your life. And it's not something that you can ignore. And, well, you can ignore it. You know, you can try to push it away. You can try to bury it. But it doesn't go away. And until you cope with grief in a healthy way, it will have a detrimental impact on your life and on the lives of the people around you.
Well, Judy, how did you learn yourself to cope with this, and how long did it take you?
Well, and everybody's different, Stuart, you know, and every situation is different. It took me about 3.5 years. For other people, you know, it'll be a different amount of time. It really just
right.
depends. But it's so important to learn about it, to understand that the process of grieving is not automatic. It is not something that just happens. You have to choose to enter into this grieving process and to do the things that you have to do to face the grief and work through it. And that's unfortunately what most of us don't know until we're faced with it and we have to learn about it. And then, you know, we can move forward in a healthy way. But
now, you've written a book called Stunned by Grief, right?
Yes, I have.
And is that's going to help people work through something as horrible as this if it, God forbid, ever occurs?
It's going to absolutely do that. And the one thing that I had uppermost in my mind when I wrote this book was I wanted to provide something to people where they could go and immediately learn what they need to know at first in one place to understand what's happening to them and to learn about the steps they can take to work through it.
Because did you turn to religion? What did you do?
Well, that was one thing I turned to. I'm a Christian, so my faith was a strong part of that. But there are practical things that you also have to do to work through the grief. It's a process of getting all of those feelings and thoughts and worries and concerns and all of that up and out.
Sure, and now you've laid this all out in your book, Stunned by Grief.
Yes.
Can you tell the folks out there how they can find your book and buy your book?
Yes. Well, the best way that they can get in touch with me, learn all different kinds of things about grief, find the books and everything else is through my website, which is stunnedbygrief.com. And if they go there, they'll find a blog with about 60 articles about all different kinds of things related to grief. They'll find the books, they'll find audio interviews and all kinds of helpful materials that will help them understand what's happening to them and the positive things that they can do to face it and work through it.
That's wonderful. And folks, I want to thank Judy for coming on the show. And we've been speaking to Judy Brizendine and her book, Stunned by Grief. And you can go to stunnedbygrief.com, right?
That's correct.
Judy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. Buyyourtimeshare.com. That's buyyourtimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Welcome back to the show. I've got a fascinating guest online. I'm talking to Karna Bodman. Aparna is quite a lady. She was at one time the number one highest ranking lady in the White House. She worked under Ronald Reagan, and she has written a few books that are really good that we're going to talk about, but most important, she has quite an amazing background, and she's been in places where many people will never have the opportunity to ever be in or see. Karna, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Stuart. Great to be with you today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Karna, tell us a little bit about your background, because you're quite a person.
Oh. Well, in Washington, there's really nothing unusual, because there's so many people that have worked for various administrations. But, no, my first job was actually as a television news reporter and anchor out in San Francisco and then here in Washington. And years ago, of course, when I was on the air in San Francisco, I did meet then-Governor Reagan of California and got to know his people. Then when he was elected president, I was already in Washington, and I was called in and offered a job as deputy press secretary, deputy to Jim Brady. Later, we switched a lot of jobs around. I was there for 6 years, and my last job was senior director and spokesman for the National Security Council. So I had a chance to go to arms control talks with the Soviets and, you know, summit meetings and that sort of thing, and focus on foreign policy, although always trying to keep in touch with domestic issues as well.
You were there when they tore the wall down in Berlin, weren't you?
Well, actually, they tore the wall down in 89 under Bush, but Reagan laid the groundwork, of course. In fact, I remember a great line from Maggie Thatcher along about that time where she said, "You know, Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without firing a shot." Kind of a good line. No, those were incredible days. We had our ups and downs, of course. Everybody administration, I mean, everyone does.
Sure, but we had a president who was a leader. We had a true leader in the office.
Well, looking back, exactly. He was a leader. He had certain principles. We knew what they were. You'd go to a cabinet meeting, and you knew there was going to be maybe four options, and we all said, he's going to take option B. We know that because that's what he believes.
And the things that are going on today, I mean, even though there was always rivalry, but he and Tip O'Neill, they were friends.
Absolutely. In fact, there's some very poignant stories out there about how even though they disagreed on just about everything, they used to say after 6 o'clock were a couple of Irishmen sitting down with a drink, you know, in the Oval Office.
Sure.
And the poignant story has to do with the fact that when the president was shot and was in the hospital, Tip O'Neill actually came to his bedside and held his hand and said a prayer. I mean, it was incredible. I can't imagine anything like that happening today.
No, it is such a different world today.
It's a totally different world, and it's unfortunate, as we've seen all this nonsense playing out in Washington. I'm in Washington right now, just for a couple of weeks, and it's crazy.
It really has changed. So, you know, one of the most, just as an aside, one of the most exciting moments of my life, I was young, and I was going to UCLA, and I was walking across the campus one day, and there were like four people on the steps of one of the buildings, and one of them was in a cap and gown, and what they were doing was giving an honorary degree. And I went over, nobody stopped me, and I shook his hand and had a nice little talk with Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, there you go. In fact, I understand there are a couple of new books out about Eisenhower and how he made decisions and what happened and how tough. Talk about a leader.
Yes.
One's called Ike's Bluff, I heard about. Another one is about Ike and Dick. I think I forget the exact title. But there are a lot of people looking back now at what leadership means.
We sure don't have it today. I don't think we have it in the House, in the Senate, and certainly not in the executive office.
Could you tell me exactly why this isn't an oxymoron, leading from behind? I mean, really.
It sure is. You know, tell us a little bit about the books you've written.
Well, thank you. After I left the White House, I worked in the private sector for a while, but I'd always wanted to write a novel. A lot of people who work in various administrations write memoirs. I mean, most everybody does, but I didn't want to do that. What I wanted to do was write political thrillers. I love the genre. And I wanted to write political thrillers, but based on real real threats to our national security, at least the way I see them.
Well, sure. Well, that's the way to write a book, because you can say the truth, but you don't have to quote people.
Right. It doesn't have to be cleared by the CIA. So yes. In fact, my first book, Checkmate, which came out a few years ago, was inspired by Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, missile defense, that sort of thing. And missile defense also plays into the new book, Checkmate, which is out there now. If anybody likes thrillers and wanted to check it out, they could go to my website, which is just my name, KarnaBodman.com, KarnaBodman.com. The reason I mention that is that my publisher recently just released the first five chapters. So you can click on it right there on the website, and you can read the first five chapters for free.
I'm going to do that. I can't
wait.
You
know, if you like the story, then you can go ahead and maybe want to read the rest of it. And if you don't like it, then you saved your money. You didn't buy the book. That's okay. It's a little marketing idea, but really, KarnaBodman.com.
It's a good one.
Sure. And then the other thing I often mention in interviews like this is that if someone does decide to buy the book, all the links are right there on the website, then either for themselves or maybe for a gift for somebody, they could drop me a line, an email through the website. The contact is there. And I'd be delighted to send them an autographed book plate. And then you peel off the back, you stick it in the book, you've got an autographed book.
Well, that is wonderful. That is wonderful.
Sure.
I'm going to do
no
that.
No problem. But that story, Castle Bravo, and by the way, I stole the title, that was the name of a top-secret government project that plays into the story of the book.
You borrowed it. You borrowed the title.
And, well, no, when it was declassified, I borrowed the title. That's true, and it sort of fits. People wonder where I got it. but the story was, that one was inspired by a conversation I had some time ago with a major general who's in charge of our entire missile defense system worldwide. And what's interesting is I really think this is an important system because I was there when Reagan came up with it, announced the whole thing, and
yes.
Oh my gosh, what a mess that in the beginning. I just mean everybody said, "Oh, it's never going to work." He thinks he's Superman, bullet heading a bullet. But I wish the man were alive today because it's been working. I mean, we've had something like 65 or something successful tests against ballistic missile targets. I wish Reagan were alive to see it. Anyway, the general explained something to me. He said, "Karna, let me tell you why we really need an expanded missile defense system. We have some interceptors out on the West Coast by Santa Barbara, but nothing on the East Coast, although they're talking about looking around to see where you could put them. The only trouble is there's no money, and they also have to file an environmental impact statement. Now, what would be an environmental impact if we had an attack? Well, I don't know if they figure that in there, but
you need an environmental impact for everything today.
Yeah, right.
Even to run business.
Right. So the general said, "Look, let me paint a scenario for you." He said, "Let's imagine it's a few years down the road, and some group, militant group, or country doesn't like us. Yeah, they're out there. Somehow gets hold of a small nuclear device. It could be just a small
dirty bomb.
They're all trying, right?
I mean,
Pakistan's got 100. Okay, and they also get hold of a delivery vehicle, meaning some sort of a missile you could strap it onto. Now, it could be as simple as a Scud missile. Now, a Scud missile, by the way, you can buy from a black market arms dealer for about $100,000. Some guy tried to sell one on eBay, and the FBI caught him. So let's say they're out there in a disguised fishing boat or something off the coast. You'd never find them. And he went on, let's say that their plan is not to aim it toward New York or San Francisco or any place, which would be unbelievable. No. What they're going to do is they're going to aim it straight up in the air and detonate it 50 miles up or more. Scud missile goes that far. And what happens in that eventuality, it doesn't kill you on the ground. No. But what happens is, think of shock waves emanating from that detonation way up in the atmosphere.
Sure.
Those shock waves are called an EMP, electromagnetic pulse. And what that does, it fries all the electronics on the ground. We would have no electricity grid, no cell phones, no communications, no ATMs. No sanitation, refrigeration, transportation. He looked at me and said, Karna, it would set us back to the year 1910, and don't think other people in other countries aren't looking at it.
Oh, I'm sure they are. What do you think if Reagan were president today, or any good leader, would be happening with Iran and in Israel?
Oh, man. I think we'd have some tougher negotiations going on in that score, really.
Maybe we need a president, then Netanyahu.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one. But, you know, one of the things that really bothers me the most, not just in the national security sphere, but economically, because everyone says, oh, well, Obama inherited this horrible economy, which, okay, fine. We've had horrible economies in the past, as we all know. Reagan, people maybe forget.
Well, he inherited one of the worst.
But when Reagan came in, I mean, we had 12.5% inflation, 21.5% interest rate,
right.
Double-digit unemployment. You know, things were pretty tough. And what was his prescription? Exactly the opposite, really, of this president, Obama, that's been spending us in a Keynes philosophy, which has been discredited for years. But the key thing is, look at the results of the two different experiments, if you will, of economic policy. Reagan cut taxes across the board for everybody, not just lower down, but middle income and higher income, job creators,
right.
Everybody. When he came in, the highest tax rate was 70%. When he left, a few up and down here and there, it was 28%. Now, what happened was, we had GDP growth at 3%, 4%, and then 7% versus the dismal recovery now. It's the worst in 80 years.
And, you know, it's not just the Republican thing. Kennedy was a tax cutter.
Well, that's right. In fact, Kennedy tax cuts, Steiger tax cuts, which focused a little bit more on cap gains, and of course the Bush tax cuts, every time we have cut tax rates across the board.
The economy booms.
The economy booms. And here's
yes,
the
does.
Deal. The very people that Obama keeps saying he wants to help are the very ones who are hurt the most. Let me give you a couple of numbers. I knew we were going to be chatting, but I looked a few things up. Here's the deal. Under Reagan, depending on what date you start counting, something like 18 million new jobs were created. Many women and small,
yes.
Own businesses, small business, whatever. Other groups, black unemployment under Reagan fell by 20%. Now it's increased by 42%. Teenage unemployment under Reagan dropped by 16%. Now it is increased by 56%. And then you think about regulations. Reagan, all the burden on business and everybody, all these crazy regulations, and everybody else too,
trying
to start a business.
Makes it near
when Reagan
impossible.
Came in, there were about 87,000 pages in the Federal Register. That's where they keep track of that nonsense. When he left, there were about 40,000 pages. I mean, incredible cut.
It is incredible.
Now, with Obama, it's way up there again. And in fact, there was an analysis in the Washington Post, no less, that just Obamacare alone adds about 20,000 pages of regulation.
Well, I feel that's just going to fall on its own merit. Or lack of merit.
Well, I you're probably right. We can talk a long time about that sort of thing.
We're running a little bit out of time, but I cannot
of
thank
course.
You enough for coming on the show. You are a fascinating lady. And everybody, go to KarnaBodman.com, KarnaBodman, and get her books. They've got to be great. I can't wait to read them.
I hope. That the people will, especially Castle Bravo, the latest one, and maybe we can keep in touch. When the next one rolls out, it'll be a while.
Thank you again, Karna.
This is a song about being happy. That's right. It's the happy, happy, joy, joy song.
Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, joy.
I don't think you're happy enough.
Welcome back to the show. Folks, I've got Tiffany Vanderlucht on the line. I think I said that well. She's the author of the book, The Radical Self-Expert. She's going to tell us a lot of very interesting things on how to be happy in your life, and I think that's good for everybody. Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Yay, thank you for having me.
T- tell me a little bit about, and tell all the folks a little bit about what you're doing and how you do things to make yourself happy and to change your life.
Well, I think that we've been fed over these years, especially since The Secret, that if we just think positive and we just, you know, do vision boards and things like that, then our life will just, like, magically change. And what I'm inviting everyone to do is sort of, you know, create a new model for themselves, especially since they found that positive thinking and affirmation scientifically can be harmful to your dreams and self-esteem. So what all of that angst and upset and confusion and frustration, all of that stuff we feel all the time is because we're not allowing our true self to be expressed. And so what I offer people or invite people to do is sort of tap into that part of you that you were born as and be that energy of possibility that then creates opportunities. And you'll find that once you start following what I say feels light for you, you'll find that you're a lot happier, and it's quite easy, and then you can choose based on what feels light for you rather than trying to follow the heaviness or think positive or do all those other things.
So you reinvent yourself, and you stop worrying about things that you can't control, I guess.
Well, yeah, you know, I think that we all get caught up in what we're all being fed, you know, about how to do things. And what I invite people to do is to stop listening to what everyone else is telling you. That's the whole premise of being a self-expert.
Find your own passion.
Yeah, but, you know, what is uniquely true for each of us is, like, our truth is as unique as our fingerprints. So we're not all wanting the same things. We're not all trying to do the same things. And when you can sort of get that what I want is not what you want, then you lose that scarcity mindset, you lose that lack mindset, and you know that there's enough for everyone, especially since we're all wanting different things. And we're here to sort of, you know, be an energy of possibility with each other and work in, like, collaboration rather than competition.
And what about a judgment? Should you make judgment calls all the time, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think that if you get out of judgment, all there is possibility. See, I believe that we are all things, right? We're like these infinite beings, right? And we're all possibilities. And what happens is when we go into judgment, then we cut off all of the receiving, right? Because it's hard to receive something from someone that you think is less than you or stupid or whatever. Like,
sure.
I'm sure if you meet someone, you're like, you're an idiot. Like, you don't you don't receive from them because you're like, you're an idiot. Why would But, you know, but then the flip side is if we think someone is, like, really great, then we don't receive from them because we think they're so great, and why would they want to give me anything, do you see? So whether we judge it good or whether we judge it bad, we're cutting off the receiving of that possibility, whatever that person, place, or thing could have offered us.
So you've put this book out.
Right,
and you've written this book where people can learn or get the ideas to find their own self and to be happy and to not be miserable being told what they have to do, really.
Yeah, great. Find your own way. Be a self-expert.
Tell us about your book and how the folks can read it, Tiffany.
Well, they can go to theradicalselfexpert.com. And when you purchase a book, there's some links on that page, and you'll get some awesome bonus goodies, some MP3s, and some other things that you get from, buying the book. It's available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Well, that's fascinating. So we've been speaking, and I think you got a little one in the background, don't you?
Yes,
that's cool.
Just the basis for everything. I because of losing all of those babies, I lost five before I was able to successfully have these three, and that was like the start of the journey, was losing those five babies is how
came
to be.
I can't think of anything worse. Again, everybody, we're talking to Tiffany Jameson Vanderlucht, Esquire. She's an attorney, and she's written this book, The Radical Self Expert. And Tiffany, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
I believe that myself.
Aren't you ashamed?
Good night, until we meet.